In this age of online maps, the word atlas comes up less and less often. Atlases are still made and still fun to look at, but not as needed in cars when people can just get a map and a list of directions from a smartphone. In science, an atlas can have a great impact, though. And scientists are in the process of constructing an atlas that maps animals that live in aquatic ecosystems across the West. Sounds like a big undertaking. Let's find out more about the what and the why of the project. Dan Isaac is a research biologist with the U.S. Forest Service based in Boise, Idaho, and our guest on The Exchange. Hi, Dan.
Hi, Jeff. Thanks for having me.
Good to have you. So this is the Aquatic Environmental DNA Atlas. What would it allow you to do?
The biggest thing it'll do is just allow us to resolve a lot of uncertainty about where different species live, how broadly distributed they are, whether they're rare, and that allows people to really direct their conservation efforts a lot more efficiently than they have in the past.
So can you give an example of how it might be used by scientists in ways that you don't have technology now?
Yeah, well, one of the projects we have currently that's a little bit ahead of the Atlas has been focused on better understanding the distribution of bull trout within the Pacific Northwest. They're an ESA-listed species, so there's always a lot of concern about whether or not that particular organism is in your stream or not, because that potentially brings with it some regulatory overhead. And they're a difficult species to sample, so it's in many cases the case that people, there's just a lot of uncertainty as to whether they're there or not. And they can go in now and resolve that in a very definitive way and get a black-and-white yes-no answer on whether that critter's there. We've been working with a bunch of people across the Northwest now to do this sort of Atlas project targeted at that one organism, and it's resolving a lot of that uncertainty that people have had for decades in many cases about that critter.
So can you do DNA sampling and figure out if the critter is there, whether you see it and have other evidence of it or not?
Yeah, I mean, that's the thing, is a lot of times these species that we're looking for are really difficult to sample, and so people have gone in and looked for them using traditional electrofishing or snorkeling techniques, but if their density is really low and you're trying to sample tens or 100 kilometers of streams, the chance that you're going to find them is literally like looking for a needle in a haystack. And so DNA is nice because the critters that are living in the water are just emitting it, and the water as it flows downstream is just concentrating that, and the sample you can take then is literally just a water sample that's aggregating the DNA of everything that lives upstream of it. And so you get a much more powerful kind of microscope to look at the system and determine whether or not that species is actually there. And in some cases, they have documented now new populations of bull trout occurring in places where people have looked and looked and looked and just not been able to find them. But they go in and do a eDNA survey rapidly, and bingo, there it is.
So you had the assumption then that a critter is not in a stream because people have not been able to find it. But now with DNA technology, you can say, yep, they're here.
Yep. And you can do that for literally every species of not just fish, but amphibians, macroinvertebrates that live in the stream. So every time someone goes to collect a sample, they're literally getting a biodiversity archive sample at that point. And so we can go beyond many of the traditional species that we focused on. We really like the charismatic, big, sexy species that people like to fish for and or eat, in terms of salmon and char and trout species. But now we can start to look at those other layers of biodiversity that come along with that and maybe have a more rounded way of conserving and protecting these systems.
Dan Isaac is our guest on the Jefferson Exchange. He's talking about the Aquatic Environmental DNA Atlas, which by DNA sampling will allow scientists to know which critters live in which streams all across the West. You can join us on the Exchange with questions or comments. And yes, we do screen the calls, so it's not like you're just jumping straight onto the air, if I made that seem like that was the case. 800-838-3760 to join in by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. I'm still curious about how the DNA is, you mentioned emitting, I'm sure we could use different verbs, but so where's the DNA coming from, and can you pick up really small concentrations in diluted water?
So it's basically DNA that's being sloughed off of the organism, and case of fish, that comes from fish slime just being gradually emitted, or they're metabolizing and passing their waste products into the water. All of that stuff contains microscopic amounts of DNA. And what you're doing when you collect the sample is you're actually running a small pump that filters water through a special type of filter paper that has a really tiny pore size, and that then retains the DNA and that filter paper goes to the lab where it passes through a special instrument that magnifies the amount of DNA in the sample, and then they can compare the signatures of the DNA for the organisms on that sample to a larger library catalog of all the DNA of things that could occur within that particular stream. And then that's basically just asking whether or not, you know, you get a hit for a positive, yes, that particular type of DNA was there.
Is the system pretty bulletproof? You don't get false positives because of small amounts of DNA?
Sometimes that can be a problem, but that usually comes because there hasn't been enough rigor and care put into designing the initial marker. And so right now, this technology is growing so rapidly, it's a little bit of the Wild West where different groups are getting into it, and some of those groups don't have as much expertise and rigor as you would like them to have. So there are instances where people are finding false positives. But then when they go and they check that marker more rigorously, they find that, you know, it just hadn't been set up quite right. So as soon as they then, you know, spend more time, get that right, then it is almost as close as you can get to a foolproof system and getting, you know, definitive yeses, definitive nos.
You mentioned the laboratory, which I think answers another question, which is the testing done on spot? And it sounds like not. You don't just do a test at the stream side and go, well, okay, we got bull trout here.
Not at present. I think they are working on some of those real-time monitoring sorts of systems, but for now at least, in the next several years, all the samples are going to go back to the lab. That also is good in terms of just the curation of these data sets, because then it's going to be stored and archived more or less permanently at that lab facility. It also allows them, you know, to, you know, check for some of these bad positive signals that they might get sometimes and do a certain amount of vetting on the actual data before it becomes part of the larger database that we'll put online. Because we don't, you know, certainly as a public employees, government employees, we don't want to be distributing bad data that hasn't been properly vetted. So, you know, there are some additional steps in the process that overall create better data quality at the end of the pipeline.
Dan, where in the West is this all being done? I mean, what are the geographical limits of where the Aquatic Environmental DNA Atlas will cover?
It's more or less the entirety of the Western United States as well as Alaska. So you know, there's something like 500,000 miles of perennial rivers and streams that harbor hundreds of different species, and we're shooting big. We're partnering with any group that wants to go out and do these surveys, and you know, if they're willing to collect those data sets following the protocols that have been established by the National Genomic Center for Wildlife Fisheries Conservation that we're collaborating with on this, then we'd love to have them be part of the project. There are, you know, costs associated with processing the samples in the laboratory, but we're pretty good at working out partnerships and ways of trying to minimize those costs.
I was going to ask you if there was specific funding just for the Atlas itself.
Indeed, yeah, and that's kind of what has really allowed us to move forward and put this idea out there and start really making it a reality is that 2 months ago we were funded by the National Fish and Wildlife Foundation to build a comprehensive interagency database and a website and an online portal that'll host the database to make it publicly accessible so people can start to see where samples do and don't exist and can plan accordingly. At present, the National Genomic Center has worked with a couple dozen groups around the western U.S., and they've helped people sample about 8,000 unique stream sites for eDNA, and the number of sites being sampled now every year is just ramping up. So I think this last year they helped groups sample about 5,000 unique sites. So over the next few years, we're going to get to where we have 20, 30,000 stream sites that have been sampled, and you know, a large proportion of those then can all flow into this online digital atlas so that people can start to use it for a variety of purposes.
All right. So the question was, too, whether it's a massive undertaking, and with 8,000 sites in the first round, yes, it is.
Yes and no, I guess. We wouldn't certainly just roll out of bed one day and say, hey, let's do this thing, but we've been doing a series of science projects based on actually larger databases over the last 6 or 7 years that have kind of led us to this point now where we've got the technological capacity to do the information infrastructure and build the websites and all the things that go along with that, such that if we can get ahead of the curve here in terms of partnering with people and having people use a consistent data collection protocol in the field and recording the sorts of ancillary information that we'd like to know when they go collect a sample, like, you know, specifically where it was collected, when it was collected, who was there, those sorts of things. We can do it much more efficiently than we've done in the past with some of the big data projects we've done where, you know, coming in 20 years after people have started to collect data and figuring out, you know, the details associated with it, and cleaning and organizing that is a much larger task than getting in front of it and having those standard protocols like we're trying to do.
We're talking about the Aquatic Environmental DNA Atlas now being compiled by government scientists across the West. Dan Isaac is a research biologist with the U.S. Forest Service based in Boise, Idaho. You can join us at 800-838-3760 with questions or comments about the use of the Atlas. jx@jeffnet.org if you'd prefer to come in by email. Is there a nickname for the Atlas so you can call it something shorter than what I've been calling it?
We'll probably just get to the point where we call it Atlas or AA for Aquatic Atlas. We usually come up with acronyms for our various projects because the words do get to be kind of long and painful to say sometimes.
Cumbersome, anyway. Have there been surprises along the way? I mean, I have to believe if you're out there sampling for things that you didn't know were there, that there have been a few cases where you said, we got bull trout here. Oh, we got coho here. Things like that.
Oh, absolutely. And that's the fun part of this. You kind of get back to that sense of discovering, and we're literally now collectively as a community of people that are interested in aquatic systems, we're going to go through this kind of this next stage of pioneering these systems that we think we know, but really at only a very superficial level because we've been focused, you know, so heavily on the charismatic species. Now we're just going to find out all kinds of new things that live here and places where, you know, species that we're familiar with are popping up in places that we didn't know that they existed. And you can see patterns within years and across years. And so it'll be just amazing, I think, how much we're going to learn by starting to collect these samples in lots of places and do so rigorously.
Is it everything that's an animal? I mean, are we talking down to microscopic, or is there a cutoff at some point?
Well, I mean, you know, DNA is the common unit that defines what is alive and what's not, and you know, to the extent that they're emitting enough of that DNA into the water column, then they could potentially be detected in these samples. This environmental DNA sampling actually grew out of soil scientists that, you know, were trying to figure out, you know, the array of tiny little microbes that live in soil samples, and, you know, they just got tired of having to pick through these things under a microscope and do these taxonomic keys that are really labor intensive. So that's where it actually grew up from, is being able to run a sample that would contain DNA from lots of different microscopic species and discern what those are much more efficiently than they've been able to do. And water, it just works really well for streams and rivers because you've just got that continual flow coming downstream and aggregating all that biological information for you.
So have there been some puzzlers, though? I mean, at times when you pull the DNA in and you go, well, we know that's bull trout, and that's salmon, and that's, well, we don't really know what that is. Have there been moments like that?
Yeah, well, yes and no. I mean, you can't discern something that you haven't a priori designed a marker for to query the sample and ask whether or not it's there. So that's, you know, one stage of the process is developing the markers themselves so you know what the DNA signature is that you're looking for.
So you register presence or absence.
Yeah, and once that's set up, then you can set your instruments to, when you process these samples, to query specifically for that DNA signature. But if you haven't designed that marker, then the instruments don't know what to look for. The nice thing is that those markers now exist for many of the species that we're most interested in, you know, sensitive species, trout, salmon, and a lot of the invasive species they're worried about. And typically those are all going into kind of online warehouses where different groups are developing those. But once they're published and out there, then other groups can use that same marker without having to reinvent the wheel. And they're quickly now getting to the point where rather than processing a sample for one species at a time, they're going to run it for 20 or 30 or 40 species at a time. And so you'll get actually a whole community picture of all the different organisms that are there, native, non-native, invasive, et cetera.
So is the material available to the public now, or will it be when the Atlas is done?
Material in the form of...
Well, just the information about what lives in what streams.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, that's kind of the whole point is that Once the samples are collected, they'll be processed, and then, you know, the thing that we do here in our Boise Aquatic Sciences Lab is we handle a lot of the database design and the digital infrastructure. So all the lab results that come back from the National Genomics Center up in Missoula, we'll have that set up in a spreadsheet that's easy for people to use, and that'll be linked to a dynamic map that's online, so people can click on things and download the information that came from that specific site, and it'll be formatted so people can pull it into Excel or other types of programs that they want to use, or just look at the data and visualize it in a series of maps.
It seems like this will settle a number of arguments. I mean, certainly when you get into discussions about land use and the things that happen around streams, they get into disagreements like, well, nope, but that creature doesn't live there, so we can't possibly hurt it by whatever we're planning to do with the land. And this will say, yes, they are there, definitively.
Yeah, or in some cases, no, they aren't. So so there's that gray area where the uncertainty feeds into those sorts of arguments and legal battles and other things. A lot of that should go away, especially when ESA listed species bring a lot of regulatory overhead. If you can show that they're not there, then that removes the need to really go through that. In other places where they're showing up that you didn't know they were there, then of course it could build that regulatory burden into it. But there's just so much uncertainty right now, so that we'll be able to resolve that collectively as a group of people that are interested in these systems. And the nice thing is it's going to be just so much more efficient, so much more cost-effective than what we've done in the past, where we collect data, across, I mean, there are literally hundreds of different natural resource organizations in the Western U.S. that collect data for individual projects, but historically they haven't done a good job of communicating what they have relative to what the other groups have, so literally there's just data collected on top of data on data, and some of those groups are wasting time and money if they could just be sharing data. So we'll be able to be much more efficient going forward in all of this.
Dan Isaac, our guest on the Jefferson Exchange, research biologist with the U.S. Forest Service at the Boise Aquatic Sciences Lab in Idaho. We're talking about the creation of an aquatic atlas that allows or will allow scientists, when it's done, to pretty much look at any permanent stream in the West and say, this is what lives there, or this is what does not live there. You can join the conversation on the Exchange at 800-838-3760 by phone, by email jx@jeffnet.org. How much work ahead, then, to complete the atlas?
Well, we're in the process of essentially, setting up the data standards and designing the database now. I mentioned the smaller project that we have for bull trout within the Pacific Northwest. That's really a microcosm for what we're doing at a larger scale with the Atlas. So in that case of the bull trout project, we've already got a website designed, and that's online, and we're just in the process now of creating a dynamic online mapping tool that at the end of every field season, after all the laboratory results are back in, we'll just upload those results into the online tool and the spreadsheets that people can download. And in the next month or so, we'll have that done for the bull trout project. And then the Atlas project is literally just repeating a set of protocols to do that at a larger scale across the entire Western U.S. First set of results that we're getting from the bull trout project and a lot of interest in that particular species, just this last summer, in terms of partnering with the different groups in the Northwest that are interested in collecting those samples, we helped groups collect 3,500 samples. So there's a huge amount of work and coordination now that's going in and being done realistically. This is not a pie in the sky thing. It's actually happening and starting to take shape.
And some of this is going into another project you're working on, I understand, the Cold Water Climate Shield. What's that about?
Yeah, so once we've got good information and data sets on the presence or absence of a species, that is the foundation for building scientific models that allow us to better predict where these different species occur. So the size of the stream network in the Pacific Northwest is, a couple hundred thousand miles of perennial streams, right? And even with eDNA sampling and people going out and collecting thousands of samples, that's still going to be a drop in the bucket relative to the size of the full network. So to make predictions and map out the distribution of some of these species, you need to have models that can do that sort of thing. And the eDNA data sets will feed in very nicely into the sports of species distribution models that we and other groups build.
eDNA being environmental DNA?
Correct.
So, okay. We have an email here from Boyd in Wolf Creek. He wants to know, is the presence of freshwater mussels being inventoried, and what is their importance?
Yeah, that's a big one, that there are markers now that exist, and in some cases, you know, people are really worried about some of the invasive mussels, and so there are starting to be monitoring systems set up to try to detect those early on, so if they do get a hit on a bad invasive, they can go in and do things to try to suppress that invasion or eliminate the invasion. In other cases, you know, some of the native mussels are considered sensitive species, and they're hard to sample and know definitively whether or not they're there. So, you know, there again, the technology is potentially going to help us find mussel beds where those native species also exist.
A lot of people.
And I think,
go ahead.
Oh, go ahead. Well, I was just going to say, in terms of you know, designing monitoring networks now, the beauty is you can do that really efficiently and cost-effectively. It literally takes only about 15 minutes at a site to collect one of these samples, and one person can collect dozens of samples in a day. So you don't have a lot of equipment that you're using here in the field either. It can literally fit in a day pack, and you're just hiking along the stream collecting samples, and you're going to get good data sets back.
It's a really fascinating process, and really looking forward to seeing the result. We're talking about the aquatic environmental DNA atlas of the Western United States, so we'll know what lives in what streams. Dan Isaac is with the U.S. Forest Service as a research biologist in Boise. Thanks so much for joining us on The Exchange today.
My pleasure, Jeff. Thanks for having me.
All right, take care.